This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
Conversations about patient engagement in healthcare product development have long since progressed from why to more practical discussions of how. Where and how in the development process should patients be engaged? And how can we measure the success of such engagement? I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of the IEA's Global Forum. Today I am speaking with Deborah Lappin, head of the Health and Biosciences team in the consulting practice at Faegre Baker Daniels. Thank you for joining us today, Ms. Lappin, and welcome.
Thank you very much.
As the healthcare product industry has become more aware of the importance of interacting with patients, we hear discussion of various terms, patient-centricity, patient engagement, and others. Are these the same terms? And if not, how do they differ? Is there a better term that should be used instead?
Oh, I love this question because I believe words matter. And these various ways of describing our engagement with individuals who may be patients, but they're also individuals experiencing a disease. So in the first political correctness of patient centricity, there is a question about just even the use of the word patient, somewhat the way we used to think of subjects in a trial as not being correct. You're a participant. Well, these are new partners in research. And so patient centricity, patient engagement, patient partnership, patient powered, patient led, patient driven, and patient preferences. Just a wealth of terms to describe this new relationship with individuals who are going to help the product developers of tomorrow understand what is clinically meaningful, what are outcomes that matter. Patient-powered research networks at PCORI, our Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, have been created with the understanding that clinical trials and recruitment rely upon a new partnership with science. Patient-driven platforms and registries recognize the power that rests in all of us as the accumulators of data, the people who can waive a HIPAA requirement because it is our data. And we recognize the powerful new networks and contributions of data that are coming because the initiative itself is patient-driven. And then finally, when something is patient and caregiver-led, it comes from the nonprofit community. And in that respect, can offer new safe harbors for engagement with our federal regulatory authorities. And I think we're seeing that now in the area of patient-focused drug development.
Do you have a favorite, or really based on your comment, there shouldn't be a favorite word, perhaps because different situations perhaps call for different words?
That's good. I think partnership is my favorite. I'm a lawyer by training, and I think a partnership recognizes that two parties come together, each with equal contributions to the end. And we have seen in decades past this paternalistic view of our research enterprise. But if we flip that on its head today and say, it's not a father versus child, this is a partnership of equals, we begin to think about what it takes to generate science in the 21st century and in our digital age in a new and even, you know, highly leveraged way.
The conversation has really changed in the last decade where it comes to how patients are viewed, as you indicated, not as people that would be, if you will, called upon and recruited into trials, but rather active contributors to the entire enterprise of developing new healthcare products and medicines in particular. This has really changed in the past decade, has it not?
It truly has, and it begins with what informed consent really means today and what the assets are that the patient, and that's, I think, what we're going to talk about, the assets that the patients today control and can contribute are needed, as I said, to accelerate and leverage research, and they're needed for us to get it right. When I say that latter point, it is the FDA asking, are we measuring with new drugs what is effective to deliver a clinically meaningful outcome? And much of what we've begun to learn through patient-focused drug and device development is that we may be measuring something something, and even a product might fail because it does not meet an endpoint, the primary endpoint that it's measuring, but perhaps it is, in fact, effective against an outcome that is very meaningful to the patient. I can give many examples of this. One might be with what's happened in Duchenne. Yeah, Duchenne muscular dystrophy is one example. It's understanding that in systemic rheumatic disease, fatigue is an endpoint of immense meaning to patients, almost more at times than pain. And in Alzheimer's, we're working on a large project to understand outcomes that matter most to people who are concerned about Alzheimer's across its lived experience, from very first symptoms to a time when a caregiver might be a surrogate for the voice of the patient.
Right, and I've heard it said that, in fact, one should, in the context of Alzheimer's, pay as much attention to the needs of caregivers when it comes to drug development as much as to the needs of the patient, him or herself, who suffers from Alzheimer's disease. Yeah. And that endpoint should
take into
account
what
matters to caregivers as well.
The FDA has said, and this is true, they would never approve a drug based on the fact that it helps the caregiver's health, and of course not. Be unethical. But in the Alzheimer's experience, we have mildly cognitively impaired individuals who are still very capable of expressing preferences. And yet we haven't shown yet methodologically that their opinion at that point where their cognition is impaired is still methodologically sound. So that's a challenge. We have the caregiver who's there to provide insight into the patient's experience to corroborate, and ultimately, when the patient can no longer speak for themselves, to have been shown as a reliable surrogate. And then you have the caregiver whose own health is impaired by what they're experiencing, and this is a very under-recognized area in the Alzheimer's lived experience that we're starting to understand and listen to.
What is the biggest misconception you've observed in the healthcare product industry about engaging patients in the product development process?
I think one of the first ones is that, of course, this is window dressing, or that it's a nice thing to do, but is it economically going to return savings to the bottom line and revenues to the shareholders? And we're in the early emerging phases of showing how critical this is to that kind of financial return that is the parlance of our publicly traded companies. We've seen chief patient officers appointed in companies, and yet we've yet to see how their power and authority in the company might equate with the chief medical officer, or certainly the chief scientific officer. And yet companies are moving to have this notable presence at the C-suite level.
Are you saying that the company that has a chief patient officer is really using this as veneer rather than as substance?
I think we have to help it move from the right thing to do for appearance's sake into this deep level of authority in a company.
Put it another way, let me ask you if you've observed good examples where a company has a chief patient officer or equivalent investment in patient engagement, and this has made the difference. I appreciate your skepticism that we're in the early days, but have you seen maybe one example where this is working very well due to a corporate commitment?
I think of several. I think Elias Serhuni at Sanofi, who is the global head of R&D, truly believes and has put this into the R&D process at Sanofi to have patient engagement very early on as they're looking at their diabetes product pipeline. So I hearken there. I think Julie Gerberding has just been appointed as the chief patient officer at Merck. And Julie Gerberding comes as the prior director of the CDC, where public health, you know, was her portfolio. So I think what an important appointment that is for Dr. Gerberding at Merck. And I think we're going to see great, great things there.
Let's turn to the viewpoint of the patients about this. Are there any big misconceptions that patients have about engaging with the industry in developing healthcare products and medicines in particular?
I may have a personal bias here, so it will come out. But I think that too often our patient groups believe that they have to remain pure and pristine. And, you know, we're so vigilant about conflicts of interest and bias. I believe that we have created some false barriers between what the patient groups know and can bring forward in partnership and the actual table where industry, regulatory authorities, and patient groups need to be together to do this work. And I say that because I think from PDUFA 5, FDASIA, fortunately, the FDA moved into an era where it has held very important patient-focused drug development meetings and have received insight across large numbers of individuals with a particular disease. But the next step then, in my view, is for industry to say, well, this is what we're measuring today, but this is what you're saying really matters. Now, how do we move quickly, and I've said this earlier, to begin to develop the kinds of measures that we need to take to regulatory authorities with this partnership so that we can't be afraid of being at the same table to work toward these ends. And I think another misconception that the patient groups may still hold is that we don't understand the power of this nonprofit, mission-driven leadership being brought to this area of science. And it allows the parties to come together in a safe harbor place that industry alone could never occupy. And so I think that the patients today have an opportunity to drive large pre-competitive platforms where this hard work is accelerated and done pre-competitively so that all industry in a certain disease area can create the outcomes, create this what matters qualitative research, what matters most quantitative research, and weigh it and have it so that it serves, you know, right, all boats will rise with the tide, so to speak.
You seem to be suggesting, correct me if I'm wrong, that the parties, industry, patients, perhaps others, need to be convening in a safe place, if you will, because neither alone will actually necessarily reach out to the other. Are you suggesting that there should be an impartial, neutral convener to bring the parties together, as you say, pre-competitively, to trigger and jumpstart these conversations?
I think patient groups that are in a particular disease area can be that convener. So I don't know that we need yet another overlay, but I do think that the patients have a convening power that they are going to start to assert in the coming years. And then the other point is, as we're doing this and as we understand outcomes of meaning, both in the regulatory context, we have to be developing this evidence base in a way that informs new value models for payment. Because in the end, if you approve a drug and it delivers a positive outcome, but it can't be paid for because the value to the system and to the individual and beneficiary hasn't been established, we'll lose years in terms of what the patients seek to obtain out of this new partnership.
Have you observed any reluctance on the part of patient groups to engage with the industry and or with regulators out of perhaps skepticism or a jaundiced view of what might be potential outcomes?
I think there is a reluctance among patient groups to be viewed as allowing industry that clearly would like to push a molecule forward or a device forward. So are they, if they're at the table, will they unduly influence how this work is done? And so for the risk of the appearance of any undue influence, they are reluctant to engage. And I think that is a juggernaut we need to unravel, or I think that is a barrier that
is a missed opportunity for patients.
Yeah, I think it's a missed opportunity
for patients.
Sunlight is the best disinfectant, right? I would be completely transparent. We're doing this in an area in Alzheimer's where so far 6-7 companies and a nonprofit association and the FDA and CMS and NIH have all been at a table to say, how would we design a study, a qualitative and then a quantitative study that teases out and begins to validate these outcome measures that are meaningful. So I do think it can be done. And I think to an extent, we're jump-starting the whole process by, yes, we're going to do qualitative measures of what matters, insights, preferences, surveys across vast numbers, but we're going to move quickly into methodologies that confirm how much something matters and how it's weighted by an individual at a different stage in the experience with Alzheimer's, and how much an outcome that matters may matter differently to diverse populations in terms of ethnicity, access to healthcare, health disparities.
Turning finally to return on investment, meaning the investment required to engage patients in the product development process. Return on investment for patient engagement efforts may be very difficult to quantify. So in your view, how should industry sponsors think in order to justify investments in patient engagement?
Well, we're going to have to do this if we believe that it's as important as regulatory officials are telling us it is, then we are going to have cases that demonstrate in the next 4 to 5 years, or perhaps this is a place for a very hardline critical study to be done to tie the savings that will inure to sponsors with the activities that they undertake to engage patients early in the process. So can you show that that better designed trial actually delivered savings? Or maybe the opposite is true, that you have trials that failed and we could unravel those and show that, and I think this has been done and more of this needs to be done, had you engaged patients earlier, could the savings been affected, or could you have prevented the loss? And having a number of case studies done, I think right now is what we need to start doing. The justifications have to be solid and be made within the companies, and all of us together need to make creating these proof points for the savings delivered through this new form of engagement.
Very good. Well, we will leave it at that. And thank you very much for joining us today, Ms. Lappin.
Thank you. I enjoyed our conversation.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.